Today in Studio 360, the new movie Nightcrawler stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a creepy local TV newsman who'll do anything for lurid tape. And the scary part? It's a pretty believable character and story.
Will this be on television?
Morning news. If it bleeds, it leads.
What channel?
Whoever pays the most.
I'll talk with the film's director, Dan Gilroy. Plus, the young rock musician who goes by Zola Jesus. She was the quintessential goth girl. The pale skin, the songs about struggle and misery. So why does her new album sound so happy?
I just thought it would be interesting to try to communicate the same paranoia, the same nihilism, with something that just felt more productive.
Zola Jesus performs live. All that and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Delta Airlines, whose new Delta Studio provides all kinds of streaming entertainment in the sky. Movies, shows, even live TV, all on your personal devices. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Pretty much everybody complains about local TV news, but I've never seen a plausibly darker view of contemporary broadcast news, in fact, of contemporary American business, than in Dan Gilroy's new movie Nightcrawler.
Think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut.
I understand.
I'll talk with the director later this hour. But first, for years, we've known that the representation of female and non-white people in video games can be problematic. And we know that because of gamers and game reviewers who've pointed out sexism and racism and said, hey, something ought to be done here. But starting recently, there's been a backlash. The movement calls itself Gamergate. These people claim they're fighting the gaming media's liberal bias and accuse reporters of cronyism. But Gamergate has spiraled out of control pretty fast and turned into a campaign of harassment and intimidation. People identifying themselves as Gamergate have threatened to rape and kill game developers like Brianna Wu and critics like Anita Sarkeesian. Sarkeesian recently canceled a talk at Utah State University after a threat of a mass shooting because state law prohibited the university from screening the audience for weapons. We invited Addie Robertson, who writes for the technology website The Verge, to talk about Gamergate and how it came to this and what it means. Addie, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
So Gamergate has been named and going on for a few months. How did it start?
So arguably it really started in 2012, when the video game critic and sort of feminist critic Anita Sarkeesian started a Kickstarter for a bunch of videos critiquing representation of women in games. And this really huge backlash started that never has really gone away. She's sort of been harassed since then. But the thing that we actually now know as Gamergate started in mid-August when the ex-boyfriend of a developer named Zoe Quinn, who made a text game called Depression Quest that the same people also hated, posted a long post about how she had cheated on him. And one of the people she had cheated on him with, he said, was a reporter at Kotaku.
Yeah. And that part of the soap opera, when I've come to that in reading about it in the last couple of months, I go like, who cares? But really, that's just a kind of a pretext, right? For this, what has been tapped into is this larger rage and anger among some fraction of the gamer community.
Yeah. So a lot of factors sort of made it spiral. One of the things was that Anita Sarkeesian had a video that had come out really during this and kind of enraged everyone, as these always do. And then a games critic named Lee Alexander and an academic both published articles where the vague idea was gamers are over, everybody's a gamer now, it doesn't mean anything as an identity. And that felt like a sort of slap in the face to people who think that, okay, they're gamers, this is our identity, and they're telling us we're over.
So it was all of these things converging at a moment. And the targeting we're talking about is electronic and anonymous, and no actual attacks have happened, right?
Yes. I mean, what makes it sort of more than just sending a threat that, like, an angry email is that they found people's addresses and they've, I believe they've called the family of Zoe Quinn.
So there are these indie progressive games whose sales are a tiny fraction of the big games. That upsets these Gamergate guys as well, yeah?
Yeah, well, a lot of it's just that they're being reviewed. People are very angry, for example, that the video game Gone Home got the same score as the, which is a sort of small walk-around game, the same score as the very large video game Bioshock Infinite. And then they're also upset about, basically, that reviews are not written like consumer reports anymore.
Uh-huh.
That they're written like film reviews, and that they're not focusing on, you know, the graphics or the gameplay. You know, like, someone wrote a Grand Theft Auto 5 review and gave it, like, a 9.5 instead of a 10, saying, like, yeah, look, this game's kind of sexist. And people freaked out and called for her to get fired.
That's interesting. So it's a lot of things. One of the things it seems to be is objecting to the kind of natural and, it seems to me, salutary evolution of gaming into this art form, like movies in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, I think part of it's this sort of general nerd identity, that the idea is that there was this sort of insular, supposedly, community, and this was a thing that you were, and now they feel like people are co-opting it,
yeah,
even if that's basically just it being more popular.
And if 35 million people buy the latest Grand Theft Auto, like, how much of a cult identity can that be?
Yeah, I mean, the same thing happens with superheroes and comics, that there was this
right.
whole sort of fake geek girl accusation against women who read comics but don't read them well enough.
I was wondering, given that, you know, gamers spend a lot of time pursuing and enacting the fantasy of gaming, is part of it that these real-world considerations of politics and sexism and all the rest are intruding into their pure fantasy world, and that in some way that they're not even quite conscious of is freaking them out?
I think they're pretty conscious of it. People have written to me and they've said that, look, like, I'm a gamer. I like to play games. I like to not have to be reminded of all of this stuff in the real world. Like, you know, whether there are women, I don't want to have to be reminded that people think I'm sexist. I don't want to have to be reminded of all this. They use the phrase political correctness a lot, or censorship.
How large a fraction of gamers do you think the Gamergate people represent?
I mean, first of all, it depends on what you call gamers, because if you're just talking about play games, it's an incredibly tiny fraction.
Right.
If you're talking about the people who have tended to call themselves hardcore gamers,
right,
I'd still say it's a tiny fraction.
Do you feel like this is a passing thing, this backlash, and gaming culture and the industry will just keep evolving and this will have been a odd bump in the road? Or is it some terrible, irredeemable thing in gaming culture?
I think it's arguably more of a terrible thing in internet culture, that this is kind of the final state of a lot of free-floating harassment and anger that's been going around for years. And it's also a little bit the dark side of, like, hacktivist groups like Anonymous.
Uh-huh.
It's these groups of people who have a lot of free time, who are just really dedicated to bringing something down, whether or not that is in any way proportionate.
Addie Robertson, this has been very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Addie Robertson is a reporter for The Verge. So, what do you all think? Is this just a problem with video game geeks? Or is it something broader and deeper, a problem with anonymous nastiness on the internet in general? Let us know at studio360.org. A couple of weeks ago, we launched our latest listener challenge, the Great Doodle Dare. Cartoonist Alison Bechdel supplied the start of a drawing, and we're asking you to finish it any way you want, any materials you want. We've already gotten some terrific submissions.
My name is Bob Crone. I live in Prairie Village, Kansas, suburb of Kansas City. I noticed from the drawing we were given, it looked like the character was climbing up something, but I wanted to go against convention and wondered what she could be doing if he was more horizontal. And when I looked at it, my first thought, especially because it's World Series time, was that she was sliding into base. No wonder that was my first thought, right? Kind of what was on my mind at the time was baseball.
My name is Kathleen. I live in Prescott, Arizona. My husband called it a noodle doodle. that looks like somebody who's struggling with a bag full of spaghetti. This young woman who's fighting the spaghetti, she has a tattoo on her arm, the first initial of my new grandson, which is Weston.
That's the way the dip-to-doodle works.
You can see Kathleen and Bob's drawings and all the other submissions so far at studio360.org. While you're there, go ahead and download Allison's unfinished drawing and see what you can do with it. Make sure you get it back to us by November 10th at midnight.
The dip-to-doodle is easy to find. It's almost always in the back of your mind. You never know it until it's too late. And then you're in such a terrible state. Like the moon jumped over the cowhead diddle. That's the way the dip-to-doodle works.
Coming up next, Dan Gilroy's been a screenwriter for the last 25 years, like his father before him. And when he finally decided to direct his own movie, he didn't have to look any farther than his own family. His brother Tony Gilroy produced it, his twin brother John was the editor, and his wife Renee Russo is one of the stars.
We all strive to be honest with each other. So if one of us sees something that the other is doing that we literally creatively don't like, we will always speak it.
I'll talk with director Dan Gilroy next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Delta Airlines, whose long-haul fleet has flatbed seats available with direct aisle access. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Ready on camera, one with Keith.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson.
And Q Howard.
I don't have to tell you things are bad.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty.
I'm not just an entertainer. I'm an influence, a wielder of opinion, a force.
For the last few decades, Hollywood has had a pretty romantic view of journalism. Most of the time, we see journalists fighting the good fight, comforting the afflicted, afflicting the comfortable, and all that. But not in the new movie, Nightcrawler. I don't think I've ever seen a movie with a darker view of the news business. Jake Gyllenhaal plays Lou Bloom, a freelance videographer. He roams the streets of Los Angeles after dark, taping the bloody aftermaths of car crashes and shootouts for a TV station. Bloom will do just about anything to get grisly tape, even if that means he's got to manufacture the bad news himself.
So you know who killed those people?
One of them, quite possibly, yes.
You gotta call the cops.
And we will, at the right time.
Dan Gilroy has written movies like The Bourne Legacy, but Nightcrawler is the first one he's directed, which makes it all the more impressive. And he's making his directorial debut at 55, which should please all the middle-aged among us. Dan Gilroy, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So this world of crime and mayhem videographers is real, right? There are people who make their livings doing this night after night in L.A.?
It is real. The market is particularly vibrant in Los Angeles. You'll find them in other urban areas around the United States. You'll find some in New York, some in Chicago.
How did you begin getting interested in making a movie around one of these people in this world?
I think the genesis of the idea goes back to when I learned about a photographer named Ouija from the 1930s in New York.
Yeah.
He was the first person to put a police scanner in a car and take photographs for the tabloids. And a number of years ago, I heard about the people who are doing the modern equivalent of the job, who are these people with a dozen scanners in Los Angeles. And I thought it was a unique world that I'd never seen in film.
So I understand that you and Jake Gyllenhaal actually hung around with and shadowed one of these crime crash videographers in L.A. for a few nights.
We did, actually. He was our technical advisor. His name is Howard Reichbrook. He runs Reichbrook Media Group, one of the larger Stringer outfits in Los Angeles. And Jake and I and Robert Elswit, the DP, our cinematographer, went out. And they were harrowing nights. I mean, the first call that we went to at 100 miles an hour was a, a horrific car crash. Very difficult to see. And but Howard very professionally shot it and edited the footage and it sold it and moved on. And it's a bit like fishing in the sense that you never know. Each call has its own value. And it could be only a few hundred dollars, but it could be up in the thousands of dollars. So there's an excitement to it.
And as you were writing and inventing Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Lou Bloom, did you end up thinking of him as a psychopath or sociopath, or just a relentless and extremely unscrupulous striver?
The doorway for the character for me was an empathy and an understanding that there's many millions of young people around the world who can't find work, or when they find work, it's piecemeal in the form of internship. So I really approached the character originally as somebody who was desperate to work.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. I'm a hard worker. I set high goals. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. So what do you say? I could start tomorrow, or even why not tonight?
No, I'm not hiring.
And I began to craft him as a classic hero, and then it didn't feel like it was plugging into the story in the way that I wanted it to. And so I started to craft him as an anti-hero, and his maladjusted emotional side started coming out.
Interesting.
And while it's true that he would fit the classic diagnostic label of sociopath or even psychopath, our aim was always at the end of the film that perhaps you might say to yourself, maybe the problem isn't just Lou, maybe the problem, Jake's character, maybe the problem is the world that creates a character like this or a person like this and ultimately rewards this character for all of his bad behavior.
Right. So was that an idea at the beginning of that, oh, this isn't just about, you know, these stringers driving around fast in L.A. trying to shoot crash scenes. It is about business and America in the 21st century?
Very much so. We approached it as a success story, not to celebrate it, but again, to try to keep that connection that he's moving through a landscape in which the one authority figure in the film, represented by Rene Russo in the form of Nina as the news director.
Accidents, play, cars, buses, trains, planes, fires.
A bloody.
Well, graphic. The best and clearest way that I can phrase it to you, Lou, to capture the spirit of what we air, is think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut.
She not only does not provide any moral yardstick, she erases the moral yardstick and just encourages him to cross any boundary he can to satisfy her station's demand for product.
Of course, one could say also that, look, it shows that moxie and pluck count in America.
And I'll tell you something else. James Newton Howard's score is a very untraditional score in the sense that there's so much darkness in our film that any new film, the music would usually be used to underline it. That somehow it'd be like, okay, now come the taut strings to understand that this guy's crazy, or mm-hmm. here comes the dark, brooding music because now a body's being dragged. James and I decided early on that every cue in the film, literally, if you listen to it, is celebrating in its soaring majesty and its energy, celebrating something bad that's going on. The score gets inside their heads and helps lead the audience down a path where at the end you go like, wait a minute, I was committed to this character and he's horrible and he's succeeding, but I kind of appreciate that he's succeeding.
You made Nightcrawler with pretty much your whole family. Your older brother Tony produced it. Your twin brother John edited it. Your wife is Rene Russo, who plays the cynical news director. Did that make it different on set than other movies you've been involved in?
It made it tremendously easier. And easier is not even the right word. I was the beneficiary of having being surrounded by people who are not only talented, but were there to protect me and what I was trying to do. And working with Renee was extra special because as a writer, I often give Renee my script or my work to have her look at it from an acting standpoint. So we collaborate on a fairly regular basis. And to have her on the set, it was just a continuation of something that we have at home. So it was, I would use the word fun, even though it was a lot of work and a lot of stress, that made it fun.
Not only did you make this film with your family, you are the son of the screenwriter and playwright Frank Gilroy. Did growing up in and around showbiz and a guy, a schmuck with an Underwood, as they say.
That's probably what he would call himself because he writes on an Underwood. He still does.
That didn't scare you off?
No, in an odd way. I think what it did for both Johnny and Tony and I is it demystified the business. I think anytime you have a parent, a mother, a father who has a profession and you watch it up close, you just start to think, well, that's something I could make a living at, rather than, you know, if you don't have that, you might say, like, well, is that even possible?
Right.
How do you do that?
Right.
So it was a tremendous benefit.
Well, I'm also interested looking at your biography, your brother's biography, your father's biography. You all began as writers, wrote for a while. Your father in his 40s starts directing. Your brother at 50 starts directing. You're in your 50s, you start directing. A, that's kind of late to start directing feature films.
Mm-hmm.
And B, given I've heard that in Hollywood there's a certain amount of ageism, they don't say, hey, dude, you're 50. Forget it. You're over.
Well, the benefit of being a writer, and when you write a spec script, is you control the material. So you could be 11 years old.
Yeah.
And you could be 99 years old. But if you write a script that people feel is commercial and has value,
yeah,
the ageism or whatever utterly disappears. On one level, this business is extraordinarily ageist and sexist and many other ists. But it also, at the same time, it's a hyper-free market. And if you have a script or a piece of material, like I said, that has value, they don't really care who you are.
That's interesting.
They want to get involved in it.
Right. So when you're just pitching, and then it's all, well, he's maybe too old. But once you have an actual thing that they want, they just want that thing.
You know, again, you talk about growing up in a house with a writer. That was a lesson that I very much took to heart, that if you want something to happen, don't wait for the phone to ring. Make it happen yourself.
Well, and, of course, the darker version of that, as I hear you describing it, is, of course, the Lou Bloom character who has no training, no connections, no anything. But he, by God, I'm going to go do it and get tape that they have to buy because it's so great.
I think I see him as an uber capitalist, as somebody who sees only the bottom line, and he's decided that he's going to pursue his own goals at any cost.
Dan Gilroy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dan Gilroy's movie Nightcrawler opens this weekend. November is a big month for classic mystery fans. One of the world's most famous fictional detectives is finally being retired.
From the thrill-packed pages of Agatha Christie's, your favorite detective, Hercule Poirot, in Death in the Golden Gate.
Agatha Christie started writing about Hercule Poirot almost a century ago, in 1920. She wrote Poirot stories and novels for 50 years. Murder on the Orient Express, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, Death on the Nile, and so many more. The character Poirot was a Belgian living in England, and kind of ridiculous.
I have the order, the method, and the psychology. There, I admit it. I am the best. I am Hercule Poirot.
The character spent the last 25 years on TV in Agatha Christie's Poirot, which is finally at an end. The final episodes start airing on PBS this month. WNYC's Sarah Montague wonders how Poirot, with his waxed mustache, spats, and comic opera accent, managed to survive into the 21st century.
My talent has been recognized. It is reported that I am the most famous detective in England.
Other actors have done Poirot in film and TV. Albert Finney, Ian Holm, Alfred Molina, Peter Ustinov. But David Suchet owns Poirot as nobody else does. He's built the character from the ground up, giving him a dignified waddle like a dandyish little tramp and a plump silhouette.
I worked on the padding underneath to give me the shape that Agatha Christie had designed for him, with his head slightly forward, tilted to one side, like a blackbird, she describes it. All these little things, only having two eggs at the same size for breakfast, etc.
That's Suchet speaking to a packed house of fans at the Paley Center in Los Angeles. He says he wanted to create the Poirot that Agatha Christie wrote. He's compulsive.
There must be no more than 3 spoons of sugar in my tisane.
And vain.
The brain of Hercule Poirot is like the finely tuned engine of the motor car.
And theatrical.
I set a cunning trap.
The main thing that I recall is that David Suchet had a very long list of things that Poirot would or wouldn't do, which he used to distribute to all the writers and the cast and crews.
Karen Thrussell has produced 24 of the 70 Poirot episodes.
He knew exactly how Poirot would sit down and that he would take out his handkerchief to clean the seat first.
Agatha Christie's Poirot stories spanned 6 decades, but the producers of the series set all the episodes in Poirot's so-called Golden Age, from the 1930s through to the start of the war. But Poirot felt old even then. The programmes are crowded with artefacts, blotting paper and sealing wax, gilded French clocks, walking sticks.
Bother!
Pauline Moran played Poirot's tart secretary, Miss Lemon, with her period spit curls.
Hastings, Jap and Miss Lemon and Poirot, we complimented each other, I think, and therefore the domestic chemistry drew in the audience.
The early Poirot was like a sitcom.
This ceiling's, what, 10 feet up, yes? So do you multiply 10...
Hastings, I am trying to instruct you in the care of patent leather. Something that will be of use to you in later life.
Hastings was Poirot's Watson, an upper-class twit with a good heart, something like P.G. Wodehouse's Bertie Wooster. Inspector Japp was the long-suffering policeman whose stolid methods contrasted with Poirot's superior wit.
It is no good, is it, Chief Inspector, if I just give you the answer?
Well,
no. We must give the little grey cells time to do their work.
Little grey cells is Poirot's catchphrase. It's a nifty bit of pseudoscientific flimflam.
I think one of the reasons that Christie is read so widely, more than 2 billion books sold, 2 billion, if you can imagine, it's more than McDonald's, you know, was the fact that she had this peculiar little man with an egg-shaped head who used little grey cells to figure out the crimes.
Otto Penzler founded the Mysterious Press and is an expert in detective fiction.
And I think people liked the usage, the locution of little gray cells because they'd never heard it before. And Lord knows no one could ever use it again. But a lot of what he does is based on his feeling. He's kind of knows who the guilty person is before he can actually provide all of the details and explanations of why he knows that.
The devil himself dances among us. But we do not see him.
Eh?
So Poirot talked about his brain, but he went with his heart. And this is where he's so different from mystery fiction's other most enduring icon, Sherlock Holmes.
The scientific detectives, people like Sherlock Holmes and R. Austin Freeman's Dr. Thorndike and so on, used some of the new science of the time as it was being discovered.
Arthur Conan Doyle created a character who applied scientific principles to crime detection, and this defines Holmes for his own time, the late Victorian era, and always. The Sherlock series, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, has won 4 technical Emmy Awards for the CSI-like dazzle of a new digital Holmes.
There's a margin of error, but I'm pretty sure there's a 747 leaving Heathrow tomorrow at 6:30 in the evening for Baltimore. Apparently it's going to save the world. I'm not sure how that could be true, but give me a moment. I've only been in the case for 8 seconds.
And on this side of the Atlantic, there's Elementary, starring Johnny Lee Miller, another contemporary Holmes, equally at ease with semi-automatic weapons, spyware, and social media.
Language is evolving, Watson, becoming a more efficient version of itself. I love text shorthand. It allows you to convey content and tone without losing velocity.
Because science is part of Holmes's DNA, he seems to be infinitely adaptable. Poirot, on the other hand...
He was sui generis. He was himself, his own little pod in the universe. If you tried to bring him up to date, you would lose the character entirely. He is not updatable because he was never of his time.
Yet Poirot did change, more perhaps than Sherlock Holmes. Over time, the sitcom model was jettisoned and the episodes became more like films. They were often darker, more complex, and morally ambiguous. David Suchet brought out the depth underlying the character's eccentric surface, Karen Thrussell says.
There was definitely as well a lot of Poirot thinking about his God and justice and how it works. We filmed Murder on the Orient Express at quite a late date.
The rule of law, it must be held high, and if it falls, you pick it up and hold it even higher. For all society, all civilized people will have nothing to shelter them if it is destroyed.
It's a higher justice than the rule of law, monsieur.
Then you let God administer it, not you!
We don't hear Sherlock Holmes agonize over the human side of a moral dilemma. The modern adaptations all emphasize his peculiar strain of social autism. They may never reimagine Poirot, with his mustache wax and his spats and his je ne sais quoi, for our century, although I would love to see someone try. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Montague.
PBS begins airing the final three episodes of Agatha Christie's Poirot this month, and all 70 episodes of the series are available for streaming if you're up for a serious binge. Still ahead this hour, Nika Rosa Danilova is only 25 years old, but she's been determined to make it in music for more than half her life.
Seriously, it was like getting Juilliard admission packets delivered to my house when I was 12 years old.
Nika Danilova, who performs as Zola Jesus, plays live for us next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. If you're going to be in New York City on November 18th, I want to invite you to join me at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space. We are teaming up with the folks from Story Collider for an evening of stories and music. The theme is science heroes, great scientists who inspire us and sometimes let us down. We'll also have songs live by Yasha Hoffman drawn from obituaries. You can find out more about the show and buy tickets at studio360.org. Every so often, we like to share stories about how art changes people's lives. Yilla Natalie grew up outside Washington, D.C. When she got to high school, it nearly swallowed her whole.
I was one in a sea of 4,500 kids, and really took me a long time to find any kind of identity in that school. It was a really tough place to be a teenager.
Yilla had grown up studying ballet, but her family couldn't afford classes anymore. Add to that, puberty.
I mean, I went from being a stick pole with, you know, flat chests and, you know, perfect ballet body to a D cup overnight. And I didn't really know what to do with it. I was no longer, definitely didn't look like a ballerina anymore. And so I kind of gave that up and slowly learned to not really like the way I looked or feel very comfortable with myself.
It was 1991, so like pretty much every high schooler in America, Yilla was into U2, big time. Achtung Baby had just come out.
I bought this video compilation, and I believe it was called Interference. I bought it on VHS, and I popped it in one day. It had all the videos from the Achtung Baby album. And in between the videos, there were little sound bites and interviews. And right before the Mysterious Ways video, very quick sound bite of Bono saying,
I have a weakness for belly dancers.
I have a weakness for belly dancers. This video was really tantalizing. There were scenes in Morocco and, you know, beautiful white buildings. And then a belly dancer shows up, and her movements were like butter. She had a beautiful curvy body and long dark hair, and she was dancing in a way that was very feminine. this woman that he's describing, this dancer, she was able to make Bono go down on his knees. And to me, that was so powerful that she could take this amazing rock star and make him suffer so really blew my mind. That's when I decided, you know what? I want to have that kind of power. And I want to be able to not necessarily make men feel that way. That really wasn't the aim, but to have that level of power. And so I would watch the video and try and emulate her. And I got some of the moves down before I ever set foot in a classroom. It's been over 20 years since I saw that video. Now I am a belly dance instructor and performer, and I've been performing at weddings and in restaurants and in people's living rooms and on stages for the last 10 or so years. The women that I teach are not teens, they're older women. They have children, they're lawyers, they come from all walks of life, but they still have that sense that they're not beautiful enough or powerful enough or good enough. But when you get to stand in front of a group of people that you don't know, that don't know you, and when you walk into the room with this amazing bang of music, you feel in control and you feel beautiful. It's really not about them desiring you. That to me was always a byproduct. If they desire you, that's on them. But that really wasn't the aim. The aim was to make people happy. And so I've seen it turn women's lives around. I've seen it change their entire mode of thinking about the power that they possessed and didn't know that they had. So it's a real blessing. Bono has not seen my belly dancing yet, and he's running out of time because I'm 40 now, so I don't want to be doing this too much longer. I'd rather teach. So Bono has to hurry up if he wants to see this amazing product that he's created. And I'm sure he'll love it.
Gil and Natalie lives in Washington, D.C. She listens to the show on WAMU, W-A-M-U. Our story was produced by Studio 360's Jenny Lawton with help from Arielle Roland-Waring. Is there a song or book or movie or some other cultural work that has altered your trajectory in a big way? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org and we might put your story on the air. The singer-songwriter Nika Rosa Danilova is tiny, 4 feet 11. But when she performs as Zola Jesus, she becomes kind of a massive figure. Her music is sort of old-fashioned rock, a little dark and gothy, plus interesting electronics, and it is epic. Nika Danilova is only 25, but she has just released her sixth album, which is out now and called Taiga, and she is here with me now, Zola Jesus.
Hello.
You're here.
I'm here.
Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
May I call you Nika Danilova?
You can call me Nika. Yeah.
No, I want to say the whole thing.
Okay,
then I
yeah.
feel like I'm in a Soviet,
right?
Cold War epic. Yeah. But before we talk, will you play a song?
Yes, of course.
And you'll play Dangerous Days, maybe?
Yes.
Speaking of Soviet spy things?
Yep.
Thanks.
Never were the one for us. And never-
That was Zola Jesus and her band performing Dangerous Days off the new record Taiga. You can never, that was wonderful, and you can never have too much percussion in a song for me. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
This song is the first single off this album, and it's such a genuine pop song. I just wanted to start running or going to the gym or something as I was listening to it.
Productive, though.
Which is not like a lot of songs you've done in the past. You have made this name as being this gloomy, dark, brooding figure. Is this a new sunny phase in your lifetime in music?
Not necessarily. I just thought it would be interesting to try to communicate the same paranoia, the same nihilism with something that just felt more productive.
Uh-huh.
Music that doesn't dwell on it but tries to find a solution or tries to find solace in those things that before I felt kind of thwarted by.
Because the lyrics are still a little dark.
Yes, yeah, and they always will be because that's just who I am. But it's interesting to find dichotomies, and this is just another excursion in that.
Nika Danilova is a fantastic name. I could imagine it being a stage name. Why and when did you decide to record as Zola Jesus?
That's just the name that I'd started from the very beginning because when I started making music, all my friends were in bands. They were like in punk bands and garage rock bands, and they all had band names.
Really?
And I was this girl making solo music with a keyboard, and it was already very different, but I wanted a band name to make it feel more like a band. So Zola from Emile Zola and Jesus from Jesus
Did you
Christ.
Were either Emile Zola or Jesus Christ big heroes of yours when you were taking these names?
No, but I like, again, there was a dichotomy. You know, Emile Zola was for truth and Jesus was for spirituality or faith. And I liked how it, honestly, I liked how it sounded.
And even though you grew up in the middle of nowhere in northern-ish Wisconsin, mm-hmm. On 100 acres, it was a pretty bohemian little house on the prairie. Your father listened to Oingo Boingo and Talking Heads. And so that was the stew in which you were marinating?
Yeah, I mean, my dad, I grew up listening to, like, Talking Heads, Squeeze, Oingo Boingo, Dead Kennedys, stuff like that. Bob Dylan, my mom listened to Janis Joplin.
Really? They're, like, different generations.
Yeah, well, she's much more into, like, soulful singers and like, yeah, 60s and 70s rock.
You started, I read, at age 7, buying little tapes to teach yourself how to sing opera?
Yeah, they were in the back of the Rolling Stone magazines.
Really? I didn't see those ads.
Yeah, there were always ads in the back of Rolling Stone, and there were some teach yourself how to sing.
But specifically opera?
Well, I mean, that's basically I wanted to learn how to sing, and then the voice teacher that I found in Wisconsin was an opera teacher.
Uh-huh. And that seemed desirable to you as a 7-year-old?
I was a preemie, and I still am. So I liked the idea of utilizing your body in a way that makes you sound so uh-huh. much bigger than yourself.
But did you think at 8, 9, 10, 12, as a kid, like, I want to make my living doing this?
Yeah. I mean, I seriously was like getting Juilliard admission packets delivered to my house when I was 12 years old and like filling them out. And it's just the thing. I just became fixated on the idea of this being my life. In like an unexplainable way.
And at 12, you're filling out applications for Juilliard. Why did you then go to college and study philosophy?
Because my parents told me to have a backup plan.
Philosophy. That's a good backup plan.
Well, no, I studied business first because they wanted me to have a real backup plan. Uh-huh. And then I was like, why am I doing this? This is uh-huh. completely the opposite.
To write the songs on this album, I understand you sequestered yourself on this hipster suburb of Seattle called Vashon Island, where you knew nobody at all. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And did you expect to emerge with this very different sound as a result?
Honestly, that's how I write. And in the past, I wrote pop music. It just had a lot of noise over the top, you know? And that's because I liked that. I liked taking a song that could be a pop song
and
then destroying
it. Yeah.
Yeah. And this, I just liked the idea of embracing the poppiness.
Uh-huh.
This time around.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't want to repeat myself, so you keep deconstructing, and at some point you can't deconstruct anymore, so you need to reconstruct.
I get it. So are you done deconstructing and reconstructing, or is this two albums away, you'll be doing something significantly different, do you
It's
think?
Always going to be different.
Yeah?
Yeah, I could write an opera next, I mean, at this point.
I can imagine you writing an opera.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Okay.
But before you do that, will you play another song, play us out with Dust?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
Don't let it get too far away. This world is not to blame. You've got to
That's Nika Rosa Danilova, Zola Jesus, and her band. Alex DeGroot, Daniel Eaton, and Mikey Pino performing her song Dust, which is on her brand new record, Taiga. You can hear all the songs she performed for us today at Studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Penamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azule,
Amira Nader,
Scott Ross.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360... Harry Shearer has done a lot of great characters, from Spinal Tap to The Simpsons.
Release the hounds.
Now, he's doing Richard Nixon.
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency, effective at noon tomorrow.
Harry Shearer, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.